Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Just before we commence this debate, could I make the point that some cases relating to these matters are sub judice? It would not be proper for honourable members to refer to anything that is still before the courts in any form. Bambos Charalambos, to move the motion, please.
Thank you, Mr. Gale. It's a pleasure to serve under your chairmanship. I beg to move that this House has considered the safeguarding of children and young people in sport. A few months after my election, I was contacted by one of my constituents, Mr. Ian Ackley, who is present here today, who told me that he'd been one of the people sexually abused as a child by the serial sex offender and predatory paedophile Barry Bunnell, who was convicted of 43 counts of historic child sex abuse in February of this year. With your permission, I will briefly tell you Ian's story to illustrate the failings of the past, and then I'll go on to explain what I think still needs to be done to safeguard children and young people in sport. Ian told me how, as a talented young footballer at age 9, he'd been spotted by Bunnell. Bunnell used his charm-suggested connections to top-tier football clubs to persuade parents to allow their sons to sign for his club, White Knoll, which he ran himself in North Derbyshire. Ian told me that very early on, as the team was doing well and having won the trust of his parents, Bunnell soon suggested that Ian stay overnight at his place so that he could talk tactics with him and so that Ian would be fresher for the game the next day. The parents, being very trusting and totally taken in by Bunnell, consented to the stay over. The sexual abuse began immediately. Ian was not the only child to stay over. On some occasions, there would be a number of boys there, some sleeping in the same bed as Bunnell. Staying overnight at Bunnell's place soon became the norm. Now, it's hard to imagine that happening today, but those were different times. From talking to Ian, he made it clear to me that when playing other youth teams in Manchester, many parents from the Manchester area were aware of Bunnell's abuse. On some occasions, they confronted Bunnell at matches, but it would seem had either chosen not to report the abuse to the police or taken the matter any further, or else had not been listened to. Ian told me that the sexual abuse stopped when he was 14 years old, when Bunnell wound down his youth football club. Ian's football career came to an end a few years later, and in 1996 went on to become the first person to publicly blow the whistle on Bunnell's abuse in a BBC dispatches programme, which led to Bunnell being convicted of a number of sexual offences against Ian. The trauma and anguish of being sexually abused remained with Ian and is still with him. And since the recent revelations about Bunnell came out 2 years ago, Ian's personal and work life have suffered. Ian has used his experience with other abuse victims, Paul Stewart, David White and Derek Bell, to set up an organisation called SAVE, which seeks to engage with victims and others to inform and advise about safeguarding in sport and to raise awareness about potential loopholes and oversights in procedures and day-to-day activity. I, like many others, assumed that the sexual abuse suffered by Ian and others by Bunnell couldn't happen today because we live in different times from the 1980s. And sport has changed beyond all recognition from that time. But on closer inspection, I think that there are areas that need improving. Before preparing for this debate, I met with the NSPCC, the head of safeguarding at the Football Association, the FA, and with representative from the Lawn Tennis Association, and I also spoke to a number of people involved in safeguarding. The FA have an exemplary safeguarding policy endorsed by the NSPCC Child Protection and Sport Unit, which they should quite rightly be proud of. They even have a grassroots football safeguarding policy which covers everything from recruiting volunteers and staff, creating a safe environment, criminal record checks, to travel and trips, vulnerable people and even cyberbullying. Ideally, all clubs should fully implement and abide by these policies. But I have a concern about how very small Sunday morning football clubs, which are predominantly run by volunteers, will be able to ensure that all these steps are taken without finding them extremely burdensome. Yes, I'll keep on.
The Honourable Member for giving way and congratulate him on what is undoubtedly a very timely debate. Would he agree with me that the issue that he's touching on at the moment is that, of course, the young people and children ought to be safeguarded. But in addition to that, those volunteers that he's alluding to, we have to respect their integrity, the many thousands of them that are above and beyond reproach, to ensure that the very tiny minority who've been abusive are completely and utterly isolated and alienated from dealing with young children in sport.
Mr. Harold Ambus.
The old man makes an excellent point, and I think that trying to make sure that we close the loopholes to stop the abuse from happening is paramount. But we also must take into account that, that many of the smaller clubs run entirely by volunteers, and we must give our thanks to those that are genuine volunteers who are there for the benefit of the young people in the sport. I feel that structurally more support is needed at the regional or county level to ensure that small clubs get help with implementing these safeguarding policies. There should be someone at the regional or county level who ensures that policies are being adhered to and that proper monitoring takes place. It is often at the smaller clubs where the abuse will first happen. And as I mentioned earlier, in Ian Ackley's case, that's where the abuse happened. We also need to ensure that children and young people feel able to speak out and be listened to when they call out abuse. And that is why we need to make sure that they can do so in a safe environment and are encouraged to speak out. Making children and young people confident about speaking up could be done via player induction at sports settings or via other means where they're encouraged by the clubs to speak out whenever they come across abuse or if they're aware of it being anything coming to themselves. When I met the Lawn Tennis Association, I was staggered to discover that not all tennis clubs are affiliated to the LTA, and that despite having approximately 2,700 members, over 1,000 clubs are not registered with them. Now, some people might say, so what? What difference does it make? Well, this year, for the first time, the Lawn Tennis Association have made it a requirement that all affiliated clubs must only use LTA-accredited coaches who must meet a minimum safeguarding standard. Unregistered clubs, on the other hand, are free to appoint whomever they choose as a tennis coach. According to the LTA, there are over 800 tennis coaches who call themselves accredited coaches. There are other teaching courses apart from the LTA's course, but it's worth noting that some accreditation can be done online for as little as a fee of £80. This means that a child or young person could be having lessons at an unregistered tennis club with a coach who obtained their accreditation online by answering tick box questions. And whilst this is in no way intended to call into question good unaffiliated tennis clubs and coaches, as we've seen time and time again, people who abuse children and young people find a way to get close to them, just like rain gets through cracks in the pavement. This begs the question as to whether coaching courses should be licensed and have government-approved kite marks to give people an idea as to the quality of safeguarding training undergone by the coach. Perhaps this could be the role for the Child Protection and Sport Unit to already give ratings in sport to governing bodies. It's often hard for parents to navigate all the different accreditation and codes, and anything that makes things simpler and easier to understand should be encouraged. More needs to be done with regards to summer sports courses. As things stand, there'll be nothing to stop me or anyone else from hiring a field and setting up my own summer football skills course for kids. With some clever marketing, I could be up and running with some cones, bibs and footballs. I think more checks need to be carried out in these casual arrangements too. It would be the sort of thing that local authorities, training standards teams perhaps, could check, provided they had the funding to do so.
The Honourable Member, give way.
I'll give way.
I congratulate the Honourable Member on securing this debate today. But does the Honourable Member agree that all sports clubs at whatever level, when they're dealing with children, should have whistleblowing policies which would refer themselves to maybe a government or sports organisation which would be available for parents and children alike?
My old friend makes a very good point there. I think that whistleblowing is so important and it must be catered for as far as possible. There should be an ability for the clubs to report it higher up and for that for that whistleblowing to be properly investigated. Having mentioned coaches, I want to turn now to the definition of regulated activity. The Protection of Freedoms Act 2012 tightened the definition of regulated activity in relation to children as working regularly, that's to say 4 or more days in a 30-day period, and unsupervised with children. Coaching falls into this category, so if someone satisfies this criteria, then sports clubs can carry out enhanced DBS with barred list checks to see if an individual is barred from working with children. However, it's an offence for a club to ask for an enhanced DBS check on an individual if the role doesn't require one. So, for example, the coach who coaches the youth team every Thursday night would be classified as falling into this category, but his or her assistant, who's technically supervised by the coach, wouldn't be caught by this legislation. Being supervised does not always prevent abuse from happening, as it often happens in plain view, with people disbelieving that someone whom they've got to know well and even considered a friend could ever commit such vile acts of abuse.
The Honourable Member, give way.
I'll give way to my friend.
Thank you, and I congratulate my Honourable friend for securing this debate. I'd like to put on record my support and complete admiration to those victims who have so bravely spoken out about these terrible, terrible experiences at the hands of Barry Bunnell. They were let down. My constituents, who were victims, are fighting tirelessly so that something like this can never happen again, and it is so important that no stone is left unturned.
Do not refer to cases that are before the courts, Mr. Harold Anders.
I think my honourable friend was making reference to convictions of people who have been convicted of that, and I think we should congratulate the people who came forward and whose cases did lead to convictions. There are obviously going to be, there may be more cases that will follow, but we don't want to go into that area. But my friend does make a good point about the bravery of the people that came forward. A predatory individual could quite simply seek a supervised role with a sports club which could allow him or her access to children and young people who could be groomed over a long period of time, and having built a trusting relationship with them, they could be exploited and abused. There is evidence that shows that adults who have been barred from working with children will continue to try to get access. The NSPCC have discovered that since the definition of regulated activity was changed in 2012, that over 1,100 people whom have been barred from working with children because they pose a threat have been caught applying to work in regulated activity by DBS. There are no stats in relation to unregulated activity that I'm aware of. Sports clubs can find it complex to try and identify which roles should be classified as regulated activity and which should not, and could be at risk of committing an offence of overchecking if they decide to carry out a DBS check with barred list information on an individual in a role that does not require it. It is clear to me that this places sports clubs in a difficult position and that the definition of regulated activity needs to be amended and widened. Another area that needs re-examining is the positions of trust as defined by Section 21 and 22 of the Sexual Offences Act 2003. As the law stands currently, children are protected from being groomed into sexual relationships by trusted adults with power and influence over them. This applies to teachers, social workers and doctors, but does not apply to sports coaches or youth leaders. This creates the absurd situation whereby if a PE teacher teaching football at school were to engage in sexual activity with a 16-year-old child, then that would be an offence. But if the same individual is in a sports coaching role, did the same thing outside school, this would not. There should be no distinction between the two, and the law needs to change accordingly.
I congratulate him on obtaining the debate. And whilst we can put the safeguards in place going into the future, what more can be done to help those victims that have been traumatised? Those people that are living with it now, day in, day out. What more can be done to help those people?
Mr. Harold Ambos.
I
It's an excellent question posed by my honourable friend. I think there does need to be a lot more support for those people in relation to their mental health. Many people are suffering trauma as a result of the events that happened in the past. We need to make sure that there is a proper support network for them, that they get the counselling and advice and therapy that they need to come to terms with the appalling effects of historic sexual abuse that may have arisen. Going back to the area of positions of trust, I know that many sports national governing bodies want to see this change and have told the NSPCC that over 50% of all safeguarding cases arise from inappropriate relationships from sports coaches. I understand that last year the Minister announced that a ministerial commitment had been secured to extend the position of trust to sports coaches, and I invite the Minister to update us on the current progress of that commitment. Closer working with police would also be necessary. I've been made aware of instances where the police have suggested that an individual may pose a risk to children at a sports club, which leads to that individual's suspension, only for the police then to take no further action because the suspension means that there's no longer a risk. This sort of practice exposes clubs being challenged about their decisions to suspend and may also have an adverse effect on an innocent individual. Many victims of abuse will need advice and support when reporting, and also in the aftermath when they may be suffering depression, having suicidal thoughts, be at risk of self-harm, and be suffering with their mental health. I know that last year the government published a green paper on children and young people's mental health, but asked the Minister that serious consideration be given to out-of-hours provision for support for the victims. Something that I touched on at the start of my debate was how Bunnell was able to get away with the sexual abuse of boys despite it being an open secret in Manchester and other places. It is the responsibility of us all to call out abuse when we see it. And I'd like to think that with the recent sex abuse scandals, none of us would tolerate knowing about any such abuse and not reporting it. Playing sport should be fun, safe, enjoyable, and rewarding. The purpose of this debate is to try to make sure that it remains so for children and young people. For people like Ian Ackley and the other brave victims who spoke out about their abuse, and also from those who haven't or weren't able to, who have been robbed of their youth by the actions of evil men, I hope that by speaking up today and taking action now, we'll be preventing the future abuse from happening in sport. I appreciate that some matters I've mentioned may fall outside the Minister's ministerial remit, but I want to make sure that these issues have been properly aired, and hopefully she'll be able to use this debate to influence her ministerial colleagues to bring about the changes to make children and young people in sport safer. Thank you.
The question is, this House has considered the safeguarding of children and young people in sport. Mr. Douglas Ross.
Sir Roger, it's a pleasure to serve under your chairmanship, and could I also congratulate the Honourable Member for Enfield Southgate for securing this timely and important debate, and also the sympathetic way you outlined the case of Ian Ackley. And could I also welcome Ian to Westminster and congratulate him on his bravery, because it's only because of the bravery of individuals like Ian and others that dangerous individuals like Barry Burnell were locked up and put away, and also we've shone a light onto this unacceptable and despicable practice. Young people interested in sport is key for their own development, for their own fitness, and it's important we do everything possible to give them a positive environment when they are learning and nurturing their skills and developing the traits that they will take hopefully further into their sporting career or just generally as they get older. And of course it's right and imperative that we protect children in sport, but also, as the Honourable Gentleman said, protecting adults, genuine adults who want to help children in sport. So we really do alienate and root out the small minority who would use their place in sport to try and harm children in, as I say, despicable ways. I want to focus my remarks, Sir Roger, if I can, on what we are doing in Scotland about safeguarding children in sport. There's currently a partnership between Children First and Sport Scotland, working with local authorities, local sports trusts, leisure trusts and sports clubs to ensure that we do as much as possible to protect young people in sport in Scotland. The Safeguarding in Sport, 10 Steps to Safeguard Children in Sport, it's a 116-page document that was published by Children First and Sport Scotland, but it's important that everything is in there to ensure the maximum amount of guidance is available to everyone involved in our sport. And the 10 steps to safeguard children in sport is imperative that we get that down to all people involved in sport in Scotland and across the UK. In preparation for this debate, I spoke to my local sports development officer in Moray Council, Kim Patterson, who was explaining she is the only tutor in Moray, quite a wide geographical area, but she's the only tutor in that local authority area and my constituency who is delivering the Safeguarding and Protecting Children course. And since January, she has run 10 courses and each of them has had the maximum 20 participants in it. So 200 people in Moray alone in the last few months have been taking this course. And what she said to me is, a number of people are almost forced by the national governing body to go along and do this, and they approach the course almost like a tick-box exercise. They feel they have to do it. But they leave at the end of the day actually saying to Kim and others involved in the class that they never knew there was so much information out there about child protection and protecting children in sport. So they may start the course, you know, a bit apprehensive about having to do another series of training, but they leave at the end of it with far more information, and I think that's a very positive development out of this. If they want to go on further, there's also an In Safe Hands, which is the next level up, looking at child protection officers within local clubs, and that's delivered by Children First. There's also, of course, best practice, because I think there's a problem sometimes that people go along to these courses and they see it as a tick box and that's it. They've done the course and they never go back again. But it's best practice, of course, to renew this every 3 years. And I think we should all be encouraging people to ensure that they keep up to date with the standards expected of them. And I know Children First and Sport Scotland are looking at an online version for refresher courses in the future. And I think that's something I would very much support. Sir Roger, today's debate has been timely and reminds us of the bravery displayed by Ian Attlee and others to ensure that individuals who caused harm in sport were brought to justice and didn't get away scot-free. As the Honourable Member for Enfield said, we live in different times, but that doesn't mean we should be complacent. If we did become complacent, because we assume this may have happened in the 70s or the 80s, but it wouldn't happen in 2018, then we would all be letting down young children and young people in our areas. Because there has been progress across the UK. There's been great work done to protect and safeguard children and young people in sport, but I truly believe there is more to be done, and I think today's debate reminds us all of the horrors of the past, but also to ensure that we don't allow that to be a distant memory, that we keep up our efforts to ensure that our children can continue to enjoy sport, to gain from sport, to live their dreams in sport, but do not suffer nightmares as many did under Barry Bunnell and others. Thank you.
I know this is difficult, but I'd be grateful if honourable members would seek to keep names that are before the courts out of the debate. Yes, it is. Jim Shannon.
Thank you, Sir Roger. I can give you that categorical assurance that I will not be mentioning the names, but I do want to speak about the subject matter. And I want to, first of all, congratulate the Honourable Gentleman for Enfield Southgate and bringing it forward. We spoke on the train last Thursday about the issue, and I understand the Honourable Member's reason for bringing it forward. It's a very, very important issue for us here in this House. And we're all very aware, Sir Roger, should be very aware of your guidance that you've given us all as members, and should take that on board when we're speaking about it. I want to add a contribution, if I can, to the debate. Ever mindful, I'll give an ordinary perspective of it. I look to the Minister, as we always do, for a very, very suitable and helpful response, as from the Shadow Minister as well. As the proud father of three strapping young boys and the even prouder grandfather of two young granddaughters in the UK, the issue of safeguarding children is one that's very close to my heart. As close to as a father, as a grandfather, as an elected representative, as one who has been involved in sports over the years and who has a direct contact with his constituency. My heart aches when I hear of a child going through any form of abuse, whether it's mental abuse, whether it's physical abuse or sexual abuse, and I wish to play my part in ensuring that no child whatsoever goes through this pain. There are some 430,000 children under 18 in Northern Ireland, and of these, almost 2,100 in Northern Ireland were identified as needing protection from abuse in 2017. And we all know this is not a true picture of how far abuse goes. We all suspect that it goes much further than that. Throughout the province, there is abuse taking place that will never be talked about and for which justice will never be served. And my honourable friend and colleague for East Londonderry and I were just talking about that a few minutes ago. We were just saying that there's probably lots of things that we never ever hear about. When we were younger, it was never spoken about. Certainly, it didn't happen in the circles that I was in, but that didn't mean it didn't happen elsewhere, because quite obviously it did. There were over 58,000 children identified as needing protection from abuse in the UK in 2016, and this is a UK-wide issue that must be addressed in a UK-wide manner, and this is the place to do that, right here in this House, in this debate today, with the Minister present. I read the NSPCC, a briefing on preventing abuse of positions of trust, a very, very helpful brief from the NSPCC, as it always is, and I must say I agree with the points that were made in the briefing, and also that my honourable friend has so wonderfully explained this morning in his introduction. Sex crimes committed by adults in positions of trust have increased by more than 80% since 2014, and the number of offences where professionals such as teachers, care staff and youth justice workers targeted 16 to 17-year-olds in the care for sex rose to 219 in the year to June, up from 159 3 years ago. Nearly 1,000 crimes were recorded over the period, where the figure steadily rising year on year. Currently, legislation does not include all sports roles, example, coaching, assistants, instructors or helpers. And perhaps maybe and when the Minister responds, we could ask the Minister, is that one of the things that the Minister intends to do? Or the sports organisations and settings, example, clubs, leisure facilities and events within these definitions? I think we need clarification of it. We need a tightening of the legislation that would enable all of that to be covered. And again, I look to the Minister for a response. I'm quite happy to, yeah.
For giving way, and also thank the member for Enfield Southgate for bringing forward this very important debate. I just wonder whether the honourable gentleman agrees with me that we should consider the role of the Charities Commission in this. Experience of a particular case in my constituency shows that the Commission, while it's very good at ensuring clubs and organisations have correct policies in place, it lacks the teeth to actually carry anything through, and when actually concerns are raised with the Charities Commission, again, it's very slow in following up that action.
Mr. Shannon.
For his intervention, and quite clearly, the Honourable Gentleman has illustrated another issue that needs to be addressed. Again, we look to the Minister for that response, but he has rightly outlined an anomaly which needs to be addressed legislatively, is what I would like it to be, and I think today this debate gives us an opportunity to do just that, and we thank him for that intervention. Thus at present, an abuse of a position of trust within most sport contexts will not be illegal, although there may be circumstances in which the law does apply to sports coaches, for example, if they are employed by and operating within a school. The Honourable Gentleman, in his intervention, perhaps has touched a wee bit upon that issue as well.